It was, well, is, I guess, the deadliest and most destructive fire in California history. 85 people died and roughly 19,000 homes and businesses destroyed. It was November 8th of 2018. The campfire virtually wiped out the town of Paradise in Butte County. So today on Dying to Ask, we're doing something a little different. We're going to go behind the scenes of a documentary that KCRA has spent the entire last year putting together. It's called Return to Paradise. My colleague Vicky Gonzalez followed four Paradise families for a solid year after the campfire. And we don't do that very often in local TV news. We don't really have the luxury of that kind of time. But for this, it was so important to follow these families and to really see firsthand what she discovered about the realities of rebuilding your life after a tragedy that is both sobering, but you will also see inspiring. But we're going to start today with a conversation with Brian Hickey. Thanks for coming in.
Nice to be here.
I appreciate you coming all the way to the back of the studio here.
Yes, nice place you have here.
Yes, appreciate it. So I always tell people two things about you, work-wise. I'm like, one, the guy can fix anything.
I try.
You do.
I think I fixed the M button on your keyboard
you
the other
did.
Day.
Just yesterday, yes. You fixed that for me. But the second thing I always tell people about the way you work is that, hands down, I think you are the best reporter on fire lines, not only at KCRA, but really Northern California, all of California, maybe the world. I mean, honestly, and I say that like sincerely, like when you're out there, you cover fires in a way that is very different than most other people.
Well, thank you. I find them fascinating. I find them terrifying. I don't like what they do. But I always tell people, I didn't start it. I can't control it, but I certainly want to be there to cover it and give people the information that everybody wants to know at that time, especially if you happen to live in the path of that fire. So,
well, and because of the tremendous experience you have covering fires, not only in California, but in Nevada as well, it was pretty interesting. The morning of the campfire, you and I were actually in the newsroom. We were sitting next to each other talking about, you know, probably something stupid at the time, when all of a sudden the calls started coming in. I will never forget kind of processing all that information that was coming in with you, because what I remember is you turned to me and you said, that can't be right. Do you remember that?
I do. Yeah. And I mean, we had covered the fact that there was a red flag warning that day and it was windy. And I didn't know that the winds were going to be that strong though, or at least in alignment with that area, the way they were with the canyon, the topography, that those were all the elements. And then of course the dry fuels that caused that fire to spread so quickly. And yeah, I mean, you heard it was starting up near Polga. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I'm pulling up the Google map. I've been to that area. I don't know it like the backside of my hand, however. And so I'm looking at the Google map going, wait a second, Paradise. I mean, that was, you know, miles and canyons away. That would, if it even got that far, you'd think that would be 3 or 4 days later in a typical incident. But clearly this was not typical.
Well, and then we started getting phone calls into the newsroom. And I remember one of them, somebody stood up and said, somebody says the fire or the hospital up in Paradise is on fire. And I remember somebody in the newsroom who has a lot of experience saying, that can't possibly be true. And I think a lot of us thought that because it was so hard to comprehend that something could happen so quickly that could create a situation where that might be possible.
I remember hearing the people that were sheltering in place in a CVS pharmacy.
Yeah.
And they had nowhere else to go. And I thought, wow, they can't even get out. They can't evacuate. And so as I was leaving, it was the end of our shift. I think you and I were both leaving about the same time. I was tempted to stick around, but I thought there's nothing I can offer at this point. The best course for us is probably to go home, rest, and know that we're going to be on this for days to come. And so I turned my scanner on and I listened to my scanner all the way home.
For people who don't know what a scanner, and Brian, yeah, he seriously has his own scanner, but basically it's the police and fire emergency line, and mm-hmm. you can listen to the communication that's going through, the calls that are going out, people who are responding, what they're seeing, what they're hearing.
I remember getting on 160, and next thing I know, I'm exiting I-80 at Douglas. And I'm like, how did I get here? Because I was listening to the scanner and just so deep into what was happening, because it was a battalion chief, and it's been well documented since, but I was listening to him live as he was driving down the road, pushing cars with his vehicle out of the roadway to open up cars that had been abandoned by people that couldn't drive. They were stuck. It was gridlock, and they had to abandon on foot. He was then using his truck to push the cars off the road, and he finally said, I can't do this anymore, because he was afraid the airbags were going to come out on his truck, and then they would be disabled. And then I remember him trying to get to another home where there were two men who they knew were at the end of a street, but the street was burned over and they couldn't get to them. And I learned later that they had actually perished in the fire. But I was listening to the desperate effort going on to try to get to these, an elderly gentleman and a younger man that they couldn't get to. And that was just one of dozens or more stories.
And this was like midday.
Midday.
Where, and here we are just, you know, not that far south and life is normal.
Mm-hmm.
I, because like you, I knew that once we came in the morning that we were going to be on. So it is when we do our shift changes, it's not unlike fire. You try to go home, get some rest, take care of the rest of your life. And then you come back in knowing that you need to be very focused the next morning. And I remember going for a run that afternoon, trying to shake what we had been listening to and thinking, here I am running. And there are literally people who are running for their lives right now, and they are not that far away from where we are.
Yeah.
Just I just have never forgotten how, number one, you feel pretty guilty that your life is going on, but it was hard to even comprehend what they were dealing with.
And with our shift, we drive into these scenes in the dark. And, you know, we generally follow the glow of the fire. That's how we know where the fire is located. And as we were driving into Paradise, I'm seeing burned structures, and I wasn't surprised based on what I'd seen and heard from the day before.
So this is the next morning.
This is the next morning. So less than 20 hours after the fire started.
What time is this, would you say?
About 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning, and we were driving into Paradise. And I did see some burned buildings, but just like Santa Rosa, had no idea the scope of the damage until the sun came up. But what was different about this incident was when the sun came up, it didn't feel like the sun came up. It was still dark. And I know you've heard people talk about that. And I've been doing this now 23 years. I've never seen a fire that produced smoke like this. And it makes sense because it was all homes, thousands of homes that were burning. Typical forest fire, some degree of light still gets through. You get that amber hue. This was black smoke from all kinds of materials burning. And even at 9:30, 10 o'clock in the morning, Mike Domalog, the photographer I was with that day, we were driving along. I show people on my phone, I show them the time tag for this video clip because I just don't think anybody would believe me that it was 10 o'clock in the morning. We had the high beams on and we were driving. I was using my headlamp to follow my notes as we were driving down the road. It was that dark.
For people who are listening to this in other parts of the country, you know, you see these wildfires on TV and they seem so big. Out here, they're very much a reality. And even if you're not in the fire zone, you often feel the effects of the fire. You smell it in the air, even hundreds of miles away. And people know people who live in these areas. So it affects you in maybe somewhat personal ways. But for you going up there, having covered so many fires, what was instantly different on the personal level for you covering this?
Once we saw the magnitude of the damage. I thought I'd seen everything when I saw Santa Rosa and the damage that was done there, whole neighborhoods that were gone. And that, you know, the worst I'd ever seen. And then as we got daylight over Paradise, the whole town was gone. Not just a neighborhood, not just a couple parts of the neighborhood, the whole town. The, you know, the thing that was odd was the buildings that were left standing. Like, why that one? Why didn't that one burn? Because everything was gone. Everything.
Did you, in those first couple of days, run into many people who had lived there, who had gone out, or were you purely in there with fire crews at that point?
Even at that point, fire crews were scattered elsewhere. There was nothing they could do in Paradise. Where we were in some neighborhoods, there weren't a lot of firefighters. There were, you know, a couple of utility crews that were trying to secure some lines that were leaning over just so that crews could access those areas. But other than that, there was, you know, they were out on the front line trying to protect the next part of the community. But in Paradise, it was, you know, it was kind of a ghost town. Mm-hmm. And yeah, there always are some people that stay behind, but anybody that stayed behind didn't make it.
No. That's the other thing that for this one is, I think, very different is that we often talk about hundreds of homes that are burned. We don't talk about people who die that often, thank goodness. This one quickly escalated to dozens, then tens of tens, and then eventually, you know, a total of 85 people. And for me, that has always been just a number that I really struggle to even think about how many people that is.
You know, when you walk into one of these areas that's freshly burned over, there's still stuff smoldering, smoke rising up from stuff. The gas lines, they always burn off, and then the gas lines they're just free burning. So it just looks like a torch. And as we looked across the neighborhood, you know, you could count 50 of these little torches or gas lines were just free flowing. And I knew, given the number of people that were still missing that hadn't been accounted for, they just, in most of those cases, just hadn't connected with their family members yet. But I knew that out there somewhere there were bodies, and that again was also different because that's usually not part of that reality.
And then the stories that the people who did get out, the stories that they told in those days afterward.
Incredible.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. The stories of survival and escaping and running from flames and
And also the stories of the goodness of total strangers at times and what people did to save total strangers and the bond that they instantly felt to try to help each other. And in many cases, that was the difference between life and death for some people.
Yeah. And you see it now in the documentary. I've seen a few clips from it now. And just that small town community. I mean, if it happened somewhere, I mean, at least there, that town was tight-knit before. And it seems like even though they're scattered about, they still have that small town charm of, watching out for your neighbor and doing what they can.
There is definitely that bond. Well, thanks for sitting in for a little bit and kind of sharing your thoughts on that. I have a couple, there are a couple things that stick out with you in your news career of, where were you when that story happened? And for me, I'll never forget sitting next to you that day and the horror on your face as you heard what was going down as you tried to piece together what
was
going on. And I
hope never have to talk about it again.
I hope not. I hope not. All right, coming up next, Vicky Gonzalez is going to join us. She will join us with the backstory on her remarkable documentary, Return to Paradise.
It didn't really hit me until I think we were somewhere near Chico or Durham. And I saw the sky wasn't really black, like it wasn't nighttime. It for real wasn't, because it did feel like midnight at 10 o'clock in the morning. When I saw a break, there was blue sky. And as soon as I got all the residents out of my car, I crumpled to the ground and just kind of lost it for a few minutes. I guess that was my body's way of reacting. Longest day ever.
That is Jenna Maxwell, one of the four families that you profiled in Return to Paradise, Vicky.
Yeah, Jenna's story was just incredible. I mean, she not only helped evacuate 50 residents in an assisted living center, but after the campfire, we learned that she went into kidney failure. So not only rebuilding and being a survivor, she needs to find a donor to actually survive.
Yeah,
kidney
failure. I mean, it was just one thing after another for her. So Return to Paradise, you had the premiere last night in Paradise. We were talking with you the morning after. This is a project that started a year ago. When did the idea for it come about?
The idea came up pretty quickly after the campfire. It was in December, and our news director, Derek Chanel, he really wanted to follow families for a year and see the rebuilding process, the obstacles, the challenges, and the successes. And he introduced that topic to me. I obviously was totally up for the challenge. I was so excited to have that as a general assignment reporter. We do a story each day and we're done. This was actually a long-term project.
Which, and for people who aren't familiar with how we do things, it's not really what we do.
Right.
And the truth is, after big disasters and big stories, and this is the knock that all media, not just television media, get, but that we go away. Mm-hmm. And it's true because there's usually something else that has come up. And so I think when a lot of people were going away, it's interesting that we went back in and then what started to happen.
Right. And so that started in December. And I had a couple days to work on it and just had to find families.
How did you do that?
I literally went down like a rabbit hole after rabbit hole on Facebook and social media.
Really?
And
so what are you doing? Like reading comments on things?
Reading comments, joining lots of forums involving the campfire, Paradise Adopt a Family, high schools in Paradise that maybe had relocated, reading all these posts and comments, and one person leading me to another, leading me to another, leading me to another. And then I landed with these four families. I landed with more.
What were you looking for when you started out?
I wanted four families that captured different struggles and also that were willing to make a year-long commitment.
Which is huge.
Yeah. There were other angles. I mean, there are so many angles that you can cover with this and so many, I mean, every family has their own story. But there were other ones that I really wanted to pursue, and people just weren't willing, understandably, to make that commitment because you're doing everything else, trying to rebuild your life,
right.
And then you have this big camera and a reporter wanting to be there for these very personal milestones.
What did you tell them to anticipate to make sure that they were really understanding what you were going to be asking of them?
I think first and foremost, because a lot of these families are private, just letting them know that, you know, we want to document their lives and with the utmost sensitivity. And what they have to say and what they are going through matters. And it will impact people. And hopefully, and I think from, and I think we actually achieve this, it can be therapeutic as well, that you can actually help people find a deeper meaning through tragedy.
Well, and there's never been anything of the scope of this. I mean, obviously there are a lot of people who are looking at what happened in Paradise, and there's a lot to be learned from it, not only from a logistical standpoint of the way you set up a town and the way you respond to emergencies, but also how people process a disaster as well. And to me, that's really what I got out of the special was, I found it actually extraordinarily hopeful and inspiring to see that you can be faced with the worst thing that you never even could have imagined the day before, but that people do go on because all those life things continue going on.
Yeah, and that was really our focus from the beginning, is focusing on resiliency. And I think that's really where local journalism succeeds in that, because we're there almost every week covering a myriad of stories, right? But we really have a more intimate relationship with this community, and it was on the forefront of our mind. Let's make this a overwhelmingly positive story amidst all the challenges that these people are facing, and rising above adversity. And a lot of people can connect with that. You may not be able to connect with what the campfire was like that morning, but you can connect with, you know, life's challenges, meeting them head on and rising above them.
Let's talk about some of the families. let's start with the Duncan family. How did you find them?
The Duncan family I found, I believe, on Paradise High School's Facebook page, because Amy Duncan's stepson, Jacob, goes to school there. She also is very active on social media because she is born and raised in Paradise. So it started with Amy. And through that, I mean, it was just such a blessing that we got to meet her entire family. Jacob was playing football at Paradise High School.
He's a character.
He really is. And he came from Pennsylvania 3 months before the campfire. So as a sophomore in high school, that's a huge transition. And then the campfire happens. Mm-hmm. And the amount of positivity he has, Amy says that he is the rock of the family.
Yeah.
You know, he really held them together.
You know, what's weird is he brought this And even when you're in the worst of tragedies, like, there's an amount of levity that gets you through it sometimes, and a sense of humor. And he strikes me as a kid who has that.
Right.
A couple of times, I was like, gosh, only a teenager would say that.
Right.
And there's a real charm to it, and this optimism, you know, that you know, this will shape his life and his adult life, which will start here shortly, you know, forever. And he was a really a remarkable kid to watch that transformation. And the pride that he had in the community and in being part of something that inspired so many people.
Yeah, he really had that perspective of being part of something that's bigger. And when you talk about humor, the Duncans, Amy and Joe, they said what got them through the fire was humor. They made a list of all the things that they were happy that got burned in the fire.
what was on the list?
for Amy and Joe, it was their bed. They don't miss that at all.
That's funny.
And for Joe, the father, it was Rosie, 2-year-old Rosie's doll that made a lot of noise.
Right.
And he was like, she loved it beyond anything, but I could not stand it. And he's like, secretly, I was happy
That's funny.
that was lost.
I watched the special with my 10-year-old son, and the thing that jumped out at him when the Duncan family story I was playing was the fact that all those people, as you put it, are living in that tiny little house. Mm-hmm. It's really hard what a lot of these people are doing.
Yeah, and it is 5 people in a travel trailer, and you really get to see the inside of it through Stephen Murray, another family that we cover, who has 2 young children, right? A newborn and a 2-year-old. And I mean, and I think even in a big house,
they're always under your feet.
Right. It could look like a tornado. And then you condense that into a travel trailer. And I do think that takes an emotional toll as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think most of us, you know, you need your space sometimes. And for a lot of these people who are living in these travel trailers, there's that part of you that after the emergency is, you're happy to be safe, you're happy to be with your family, but that reality sets in after a while of, wow, this is it, you know, and this is going to be it for a while. And it's been interesting to see how they coped with that. Did you notice big changes in the people you were following as the months went on?
Yes.
What were those changes?
I think with Jenna Maxwell, her having gone into kidney failure.
So explain Jenna's story. This is fascinating as well.
Jenna, she worked at Sunshine Assisted Living, and so she helped 50 residents evacuate. And at the time that she was helping them evacuate the campfire in Paradise, her daughter and her husband were in Megalia, and they were trying to escape. So she lost contact with them for 6 hours and didn't know if they even made it out. And luckily they did, and everything's okay. After that, after the fire, about 4 months later, her kidney function went down to 4%. She went into kidney failure.
And she'd had some kidney issues before.
Yes. She had some kidney issues. Her kidneys were functioning at 75%. But she was making healthy lifestyle changes in her life. She quit smoking. She was eating better. She was being active. And so things were looking good from a relative standpoint. And then the campfire happened. And I don't know if it was the smoke or what those circumstances were. But her kidney function went down. So on top of losing her home, them moving, you know, 5 times in 6 months and wanting to rebuild their home, not having a job, she now needs to find a kidney donor. So as the rebuilding process begins for her home, her mood improves tenfold when she sees the foundation cleared.
So you could see that.
Oh, yes, yes. And what I love about her is she has just the best personality and spirit. Like, she literally is jumping up and down, and she's just so excited, and she'll go down to her knees and just out of pure joy. And you really see that by about September. That she's just so, she's seeing a new life, a new chapter take shape. She's seeing the frame of her house, and she can really envision a future in Megalia again.
Sticks and bricks.
Right. And also, I think the most important thing, this is just recently, she actually has a candidate, a donor candidate, too. So today she's actually, or this week, she's at UC Davis with a transplant appointment. So
how did you keep up with people? And how frequently did you guys have contact?
I was keeping in contact with them every week. You know, we're texting back and forth. And I was trying to get up there once a week. And even if I couldn't, I mean, and this is really, I mean, the anchor to this documentary is photography and editing. Mm-hmm. So our chief photographer, Michael Reinhardt, was incredible and
amazing. I
think amazing.
His car drives there on its own.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. I know, right. You guys logged a lot of miles.
Yeah, he could keep his eyes closed and probably, like, get
to
paradise.
Exactly.
So if I couldn't make it, he built a really strong relationship with these families too, and he would go up on his own and just capture moments. I would just check in with them, see what's going on this week, and if something big was happening, if Caitlin's going to be in the classroom for the first time after maternity leave, mm-hmm. we want to be there. If Jenna is now back in the assisted living or the frame is up on our house, we want to be there. And even if I couldn't have been there, I mean, the most important piece is photography and photojournalism. And so Mike Reinhardt would be there, and that was just, it was just great having that teamwork.
As charming as you two are, like, having you there all the time would be challenging for a lot of people. Did anybody along the way say, I need a break, or I'm not sure if I want to do this anymore?
I think there was one moment, and it was with the Duncans, and we wanted to see inside the trailer, mm-hmm. and that was their private space. And it wasn't a big issue, but Amy had said, and it was through text messaging, I was just kind of, I always try to set them up with, hey, this is what our expectations are, this is what we're planning to do, so you're not blindsided by us, you know, I don't want to go into your trailer without you knowing that we're going to do that. And she had replied, and she said, you know, we're a pretty private family, and Joe Jr., who's 7, and he is on the spectrum. He's autistic. She's like, we don't know how he's going to handle that. So if we're not the right family for you, we understand if you need to go in another direction, but we just really don't want – we don't feel comfortable. And I immediately was like, no, that's fine.
Yeah.
I mean, you for sure are still the family, and we will wholeheartedly respect that. And that was really the only kind of hiccup
really
we had.
And that's a big part of working on a project like this, isn't it? Because you do have to have that trust. And the trust goes both ways. You know, that you're telling an honest story if you're the person being portrayed.
Right.
But then also that we will tell that story as honestly and truthfully as we can as well.
Right. Yeah.
And protect you in the process.
Most these people have not been in front of a camera before,
No.
Let alone had a mic in front of their face. And
let alone had their worst year ever documented.
Right. And they did say yes to it, but there's a lot of unknowns and apprehension on their part. And so that trust was really built throughout the weeks and the months from, you know, the first time is kind of, you know, you're just meeting. It's like a blind date.
A little bit.
With a big camera.
Do you like me?
and a GoPro and a DSLR camera.
Right.
You know, it's just we have all this gear and we're like, hi. You said yes to this.
We're going to spend a lot of time
together.
Right.
Yeah. Tell us, you know, your deepest, darkest secrets. So, no, but then after, we really, I mean, I was getting text messages from them after the special aired. And it was really touching, just saying, you know, thank you for being more of a friend than a journalist.
That's great.
And that really meant a lot.
Let's talk a little bit about Stephen Murray.
Stephen is incredible.
He's the guy you would call to help with anything.
And he will show up.
Where did you find Stephen?
I found Stephen.
Or did Stephen find you?
No, I found Stephen on Facebook. He knows everyone in Paradise. So when you're in these forums, I mean, his name was getting brought up a lot. He was also commenting a lot. And all I had to do was just click on his profile. I mean, the guy did a Facebook Live twice a day for months. So he had hundreds. Mm-hmm. And I just clicked on the one of that day. And it was so captivating. And just seeing how much he was giving to others. So I just reached out to him. He has a foundation, Coral Apple Foundation. He had contact info. I called him. His cell phone number's on the website. And that's really what set the ball in motion. And him just telling his story of helping 281 seniors escape a mobile home park, losing his home, and then even through that, having a new young family mm-hmm. and being newlyweds, engaged at the time, still donating volunteering thousands of hours, holding propane drives, getting 50 trailers for people, relocating survivors to Arkansas, to Texas.
I was amazed by how he's had this need to know where everybody is.
Yeah.
What drives that, do you think, after spending a year with him?
He has a really deep sense of community. And I think he needs to feel connected to others. And it's a beautiful thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he had a lot of trauma. His trauma really stems from he helped these people escape, but he didn't know for a month and a half or 2 months if they were even alive. And he needed to know because he cared about them so much, because his job wasn't just a job. It was connections with all these people. And he said that that's kind of his PTSD, that even now he lives in Chico, that if he knocks on someone's door, because he was pounding on all those right. doors, and if someone doesn't answer, he feels like his instinct, and he has to hold himself back, is to kick the door in because he thinks something is the matter and they're not okay. He's constantly concerned about that.
That's interesting. Let's talk a little bit about the parameters that you put on the hour-long documentary, because watching it, and there have been other documentaries that have been done about this, mm-hmm. the difference is, and I'm thinking of the Netflix one specifically, that one was a lot of fire.
Right.
It was a lot of reliving the fire. And there was remarkably little fire in your hour-long documentary, and that was very purposeful because it wasn't about the fire, really.
No, it's about people.
It's about people.
And we had that focus from the very beginning. It's not about the fire. We will have a special as well. You know, we're going to cover stuff the week of when we're in this week that we're in with the one-year anniversary. But this documentary is different. It's about people. It's not about the fire. And it's about resiliency. And so we made a conscious decision to only bring that video up when necessary, when they're replaying that morning. But other than that, it's minimal. It's completely minimal. And, you know, for myself, I usually write a lot during the stories, you know, mm-hmm. it's called tracking.
Almost none.
There's hardly any. It's maybe 99% of them telling their stories and just letting it be organic and letting them really tell their story, to share their life.
Which actually, from a storytelling perspective, is much harder.
Yes.
Much yes. harder. It's a lot easier for us to write. So I really respected the effort that went into that. What did you learn about resiliency through this that you did not know before?
What I learned through these four families is that despite the unprecedented toll of the campfire and them having to endure that, life doesn't stop. Life's challenges doesn't stop. Kaylin is still pregnant and doesn't have a home. Doesn't even know where she's going to give birth. Steven doesn't have a home, has a newborn. Jenna is going to go into kidney failure. The Duncans are going to be a family of five living in a trailer with three kids that need to go in three different directions in the morning in one truck. And what do you do with that? What do you do with your life when these and they chose to focus on the positive, and they have such a deeper sense of gratitude for family and community that I think, even if you can't imagine what the campfire was like, you can find profound inspiration in how they approach their life.
Do you think that's a small town thing, or do you think that's a surviving a tragedy thing?
I think it's both. I think it's definitely a small town thing. Paradise is tight. Magalia and the surrounding communities, Polga, Concow, they are tight-knit communities. And, you know, being a reporter and going into small towns, you really see that people have a face. They know the faces of most of these people. And I think that just in times of really tough, heinous tragedy, mm-hmm. they're going to be there for each other because they know Mr. John Doe, who lives next door, even across town. Or Amy went to school with people in kindergarten that she still was friends with in Paradise. I mean, and that is not an uncommon story. So I think it's both.
One of the things that's sometimes challenging when you work in television news is having somebody watch your story when you're standing there.
Right.
It's a very vulnerable feeling.
Yes.
You sat in a theater while an entire town was watching an hour-long perspective on their recovery. What was that like? And then what was the reaction from? Were you nervous going into that?
Absolutely. Yeah. 110%.
Did you even want to get out of the car when you got there last night?
I did. I just wanted everything to go well. Yeah. And yes, I was very nervous. That has never happened before. You know, us premiering a special on a town for the town.
I don't remember us doing anything like this before. It's really an unusual event.
It's one of the most profound experience of my career so far. I mean, it really was paying homage to a community. So yeah, I wanted them to enjoy it. And I know that there was a lot of apprehension with people who were coming because they didn't know what they were going to see.
Were they worried you were going to portray them a certain kind of way?
Like yes, some of these other specials? Yes, and make it more sensational and dramatic mm-hmm. and focus on the fire and the death and the destruction. And I was right behind the curtain on the stage, you know, I did not sit. I was standing right there and in the shadow, just listening.
Yeah.
Just any nuanced sound in the audience. And when I heard laughter, oh, that was so nice. You know, when I heard applause, that was great. When I heard sniffles, that also felt
That's
really good.
That's appropriate too.
Yeah. There was a whole spectrum of emotions. And after, a lot of them came up to me and they said, we were really apprehensive. We didn't know what to expect. But thank you for not destroying our town. Thank you for capturing the resiliency in our community. We really appreciate that.
What's the one thing you hope everybody who sees this gets out of it?
It was a horrible, horrible thing that happened to these people. But there is still hope in the darkest of times. I mean, if these people can focus on that, we all can, and still help each other.
Mm-hmm.
And still be generous, it doesn't matter what we're faced with. You can find those threads of hope and optimism.
Everywhere.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's a Return to Paradise. It's a really remarkable hour. And for people who didn't get to see it, you'll still be able to watch it on KCRA.com.
Yes.
And then we should point out, the way it is on the website, when you click on the first one, it's actually broken up into parts.
Yes, there's three parts. And so there's a brief ad, about 10 seconds. So just watch the ad and then the second part and then the third part, and it plays automatically one after the other. So just to avoid any confusion, it's kind of like if you're watching it on television.
Exactly. So you go to kcra.com, and then if you just search Return to Paradise, you'll be able to find it. So looking from here on out, what do you see happening in Paradise?
I see the community just getting even stronger. More people are moving back, more homes are being built, more businesses are being opened. And I think as a community on a macro level, that's improving the mood of the community exponentially.
I think you need to go back in 5 years.
I would love to.
Wouldn't that be interesting?
Yeah.
I think 5 years, it's going to be just night and day from even where it is now.
I agree.
What's the best way for people to keep up with you on social media?
Vicky Gonzalez TV, Instagram and Twitter, and on Facebook.
She's the best on Twitter when breaking news is happening.
Yes, yeah.
It is the best. When I need to know what's happening and I'm on the desk, I'm like, where's Vicky's Twitter?
My thumbs work at light speed.
You text like a 13-year-old girl.
Yes,
it's great.
Yeah.
All right, Vicky, thank you very much. Thanks for all the passion and the hard work that you put in. I mean, I've been watching you over on the other side of the room here for the last couple of months. Your head is down.
Yeah.
And what you're working on was absolutely worth it and a really profound look and very inspiring, I think, for all of us to see, just as you said, after the most horrible of events, that there still is hope. Thank you for listening today, and we hope you'll go check out the documentary. You can keep up with me on Instagram at RunReadSip, and we'd love it if you would screenshot the episode, share it, and pass it along to other people.